Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. But we have a national agenda and international view. A lot going on this hour. We're going to be joined by Jonathan B. Smith and Derek Gaunt, co-authors of Fight Less with More, How Master Negotiators Influence Hearts, Minds, and Deals. It's going to help you with your life, but also it's going to help us maybe with Greenland, help us possibly with Iran, possibly a whole bunch of other things when it comes to ending the Ukraine war. How about that? So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We've had data since the turn of about 2002 was when the first one-to-one laptop program really started. And that was almost the exact same time we saw a downturn in basically every cognitive skill in the next generation. So believe it or not, Gen Z is the first generation in recorded history to be scoring less and lower.
Yeah, it's pretty jarring, right? Are we at a breaking point with social media and its screens in particular? Instead of writing things out in hand, have they in fact destroyed a generation? I'll explain.
Number two.
In addition to the gross human rights abuses, in addition to its illegal march towards a nuclear weapon, the bombing attack on the United States Embassy in Beirut, killing 17 Americans and scores of Lebanese civilians.
Ambassador Michael Waltz at the UN yesterday, next step is the most critical in Iran, as that evil empire seems to want to kill their way out of this crisis. Trump is showing support, but why attacking Iran might make things worse, according to our allies in the region, including Israel, we'll discuss.
Number one.
What we want to do is continue this Title VIII mission legally, ethically, morally, and peacefully, and remove those bad people and bad things from the streets. We say this time and again, but it seems to fall on deaf ears.
Greg Bovino running things for ICE, Minneapolis on the brink, has attacks on ICE, and now the FBI, the Bureau of Tobacco and Firearms are in the city, and they're under attack by left-wing radicals who have epically, and their horrible leadership, who have epically failed. Sadly, I only see things getting worse, especially this weekend when most of these people are getting paid. Mark Thiessen, former speechwriter for Bush, columnist, Washington Post, AEI fellow. His new column is out. There is no U.S. downside in striking the Iranian regime. But how we do it could mean a lot more. Mark Thiessen, to me, this is one of the most delicate, but the most inevitable confrontations that we've had in a very troubled region.
Yeah, I mean, look, Donald Trump said to the Iranian people, rise up, seize your institutions, and help is on the way. And so when the president says that, he's going to deliver. And one of the things I respect about most about Donald Trump is that Donald Trump does what he says. When he makes a statement like that, he's going to deliver on it. So help is going to be on the way. It's just a question of when. I think the pause that you're seeing right now, sometimes a pause is people rethinking things. Sometimes a pause means something could be getting bigger and more comprehensive. And I think that we didn't have a lot of assets in the region that we needed, and those assets are on the way. And I think you could see, and I think if Trump is going to do this, it's got to be decisive, right? And, you know, one of our goals you know, pretty much since 9/11, since the wars in the Middle East, it's like we don't want to be tied down in this region, right? We don't want to have massive numbers of troops over there. We've got big problems in our own hemisphere. We've got big problems with China. We want every president since Bush has promised a pivot away from the Middle East. The best way to pivot away from the Middle East is to end the Iranian regime. If that regime is no more, the threat in the Middle East, I mean, there's still ISIS, there's still terrorists like that, but most of the major reason why we're there is because of Iran. So if we could decapitate that regime and let the Iranian people rise up and take their country back without any boots on the ground, we wouldn't not only need boots on the ground in Iran, we wouldn't need boots on the ground in Qatar. We wouldn't need boots on the ground in other countries that we can pull out our troops and move them to the Pacific, move them to our hemisphere. So this is Trump could be the president to deliver the oft-promised pivot away from the Middle East.
I just watched some of the most horrific, literally just 10 minutes ago, some of the horrific video I've ever seen. And that's the point-blank killings of Iranian people protesting in the streets. These forces, the Bashi forces and the Revolutionary Guard, are dressing in civilian clothing, walking up in the middle of the protest and shooting people in the back of the head or through their chest. Yeah. And then they're taking their bodies and piling them up. 18,400 arrests. They say 2,600 have been killed. I doubt it. I think it's a lot higher than that. But listen to the ambassador, the Iranian ambassador at the UN. Cut 16.
The facts on the ground contradicts the fabricated narratives presented by the United States regime and its allies at this meeting. U.S. fabrications of the senseless killing of protesters neither reflects reality on the ground, nor would it whitewash Americans' crimes against the great people of Iran.
Yeah. They also said June was a failure and we should learn from our mistakes. That means the bombing of the nuclear program, big failure. So, I mean, this is horrendous. Also, can I just make a side note and then we'll go back to it? Do you realize we have all these people protesting at all these elite colleges about what they think is horrible conditions and the way the treatment and the way the Israelis are fighting in Gaza? When we show you innocent people walking in the street being assassinated for protesting a regime that can't deliver water or have a value to their currency, and we see the assassination, I don't see any anti-Ayatollah protests in America because the financing's not there for the anti-Ayatollah protests in America. So it shows you how inauthentic all this is. But I digress. But you say that we act. You say there's no downside to action. But it seems like Netanyahu and our Gulf state allies in Turkey thinks there is.
Yeah, so first of all, it's your show, so you can have any side notes you want. So digress away.
Okay,
number
thank
one.
You.
Number two, I think that Netanyahu, so first of all, I think Netanyahu's put President Trump in a terrible position because he sat there while Trump issued these threats over days and didn't say anything. And then, like, all of a sudden it turns out around that, you know, that he wants to stop the action. Like, we should have probably maybe consulted with him a little bit beforehand before he put America's credibility on the line, number one. Number two, you know, what a lack of strategic vision on the part of Netanyahu. I'm offended at him for putting our president in this kind of position. And two, you know, 6 months ago, he was upset that Trump was telling him to stop the 12-day war. He didn't want it to be a 12-day war. He wanted to keep going. And now all of a sudden Trump's like, okay, now we're going to keep going and he doesn't want to do it. It's like, what the hell is that? If Bibi Netanyahu,
it's weird. I've never heard him say don't take action.
He's coming up for an election, right? If Bibi Netanyahu campaigns as the prime minister of Israel who ended the Iranian regime, I think that would probably be his best campaign, message that he could possibly have. You know, I know they're worried about casualties and they're worried about the response that the Iranians might give, but you know, you got to take some risk for strategic gain. And we have an opportunity here because the Iranian people are rising up. We're never going to go in and like overthrow the regime ourselves with boots on the ground. But the Iranian the Iranian people are the boots on the ground. They just need us to come in and take it and give them air cover. and they'll take care of the rest of it like that. They've risen up. You know, this is a once in a generation opportunity to end a threat, an existential threat to Israel, and an existential threat to the United States, and the reason why we're stuck in the Middle East. Why? Let's get the hell out. Let's end this thing and get the hell out of the Middle East.
So, yeah, it's people say, well, you could guess it with something worse. I can't imagine anything
worse. Yeah. What's worse than what is worse than a death cult pursuing nuclear weapons?
So
this is the thing that people don't understand about the Iranians. Like, you know, North Korea wants it pursued nuclear weapons because they want us to not overthrow them and leave them alone. Right. The Iranians are not pursuing nuclear weapons for that reason. Their version of radical Islam believes that their regime is there to bring about the end times. That's their ideology. They want to bring about the end times, and a nuclear weapon. They want a nuclear weapon to use it. That it's not like North Korea having one, or Russia having one, or China having one, or some other country having one. They want it because they want to use it. So that's that. You know, we've set back their plans. But you know, are we going to have when they start rebuilding their nuclear plant? Are we going to have a president like Donald Trump in the Oval Office who's willing to take it out again? I don't know. So let's end this thing.
So it's amazing what's going on here, because they say this is the best. This is maybe the best chance ever since 1979 of this regime being thrown out. And even the foreign minister admitted this started for economic reasons. It started because in Tehran, they ran out of water, and now the inflation's through the roof. And then they said, we're just going to fire what their equivalent of a Fed chair is. And the people said, no, we can't live like this. I mean, we're running out of money. Our money is valueless. The sanctions are only getting worse. So then all of a sudden the regime gets exposed as a paper tiger to a degree, just to simplify it, as not the badass of the Middle East after Israel cuts them down to size and has infiltrated every aspect of their government, killing all their generals, some of which in their beds. So, and then let alone taking out the Hamas leaders while they went to the Iranian president's funeral. So we watch this over and over again, and then the people go, listen, these guys are brutal, my life is terrible, the economy's awful, and they're not even, they're taking our money and giving it to Hezbollah by the billions still, and Hamas by the millions. So that's what forced them in the streets, but they want to kill their way out of it. So what do you aim at, Mark? What do you aim at?
So first of all, the Iranian regime has never been weaker than it is today. They've lost their proxies. They've lost their one Arab ally in Syria, which was their weapons, which took away their weapons highway to all of their terrorist proxies and the Houthis and Hezbollah and Hamas. So that they've had their nuclear program obliterated. They had their air defenses and their ballistic missile program set back dramatically. So, and now their people are rising up against them. This is a unique confluence events that may never happen again. And you either take this opportunity or you take it to your grave that you didn't take it. That's how serious an opportunity this is. What do? You decapitate the regime. You take out their ballistic missiles. You take out their air defenses from the air. You take out their command and control and their ability to communicate with each other to sort of go against the protesters. You take out the IRGC and secret police headquarters that are carrying out the massacres of people, and you take out their leadership. And by the way, just like we took out the Hugo Chavez mausoleum, let's take out the Ayatollah Khomeini mausoleum too, while we're at it, as a symbolic as a symbol of the end of the regime. And you decapitate them, and let the Iranian people take it from there.
Please.
We don't need to send Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority in to rule Iran. The Iranian people can do that themselves. We just need to help them. Help is on the way. That's the promise. I believe Donald Trump's going to do it.
So Mahsa Al-Zinajad, who's the Iranian living here in New York, who they tried to kill four times. She was at the UN yesterday speaking. She's a journalist. She was out there speaking about the politics in America when it comes to Iran. Cut 20.
This is beyond hypocrisy. I have to say the silence of left and liberal in America, in Europe, is not an accidental silence. It's an ideological silence because they believe that our suffering, suffering of the Iranian women, Iranian men, thousands of people being killed or injured, it's not like the thing that they can talk about it because it will expose their hypocrisy and it will expose that how they sympathize with our killers, with Islamist terrorists.
Look, and I don't read French, so I'm not picking up the French newspaper, but I have noticed on Al Jazeera English that it's maybe the seventh story. I looked at ArabNews.com. They don't even cover the Iranian unrest in the streets. So these are English speaking. Now, I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's anything going on.
Why? They're Qatari controlled. That's why. But look.
And Qatar likes to straddle the line, right? They like to be between everybody.
They don't want us to act. But here's and to your earlier point, you know, why are there no protests? Why is there no one marching down Times Square behind Fox headquarters? Why is there no one in Columbia? Why is there no one at Harvard? Because it's not the Jews who are killing people. Right. It's not the Jews who are acting. It's the Iranians. And so they don't care. It's only because all those protests weren't about the people of Gaza. They were about anti-Semitism. There's no Jews involved here. So there's absolute silence. It exposes the lie of all these protesters that they cared about the Palestinian people. They don't care about the Palestinian people. They hate the Jews. And that's all that was about.
So I have a theory. I want to bounce it off you.
Okay.
I think that the Prime Minister of Israel, part of this whole play, if there is action taken, is to make sure that people know that this is not about him or Israel. Because it's so easy to blame Israel for everything, just like it's so easy to blame us almost as much. Your theory on that? Even though they could fully support it, they want to make sure people know this is for you and you're fighting for freedom.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's a part of element about it. I think Bibi got cold feet. I think that, I'm very angry with him because I think he put the United States and the president, and particularly this president, in a very, very bad position by what he's done. And I think he's showing a complete lack of strategic vision in terms of the opportunity that presents itself as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But you know what? You're right. We're never going to say the Jews made us do it.
Thanks so much, Mark.
That argument is gone.
I know you have a great column. It's an important column, and it's counterintuitive to a lot of what other people are writing, especially coming out of the Middle East. So read Mark again in the Washington Post. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
You got it. Next, your calls, 1-866-408-7669.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
The actions of ICE, they are unconstitutional, unlawful, they are cruel, they are rogue, they are racist.
Our caucus members will oppose all funding for immigration enforcement in any appropriation bills until meaningful reforms are enacted.
We have to urgently pass legislation to roll back the excessive funding for immigration enforcement that was in the Republicans' Big Bad Betrayal Bill.
So these squad members, in a world of their own, want the president to, I guess, take the money away, or the minority to take the money away already allocated in the big, beautiful bill that passed legislation because they don't like the way ICE is acting, doing their job, or ICE at all. Abolish ICE is a big mantra on the left. Haven't we down this path before? So this is pretty amazing to see these people double and triple down. The horrible leadership has led to the violence that we're seeing, and I think it's going to get worse in Minneapolis. I think the president is close to getting the Insurrection Act out there, and I've been listening to legal experts. It looks like he can do it. And then you think it's tough now with ICE?
You have 600 cops. You see that unrest on video. No arrests. How could you not arrest people in Minneapolis if you're a police officer? Separate from what you see, them ICE, treating ICE, taking guns out of cars, breaking into cars, stealing top secret federal paperwork from arms or whatever, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms vehicles. That's illegal.
Show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everyone. This next topic, everybody, I'm telling you right now, everybody in the audience can relate to. There's nobody that's going to say, well, that doesn't apply to me. That won't help my life. And not only that, if you really care about what's going on in the world, the big story, what do we do with Greenland? How do we solve the situation, the constant back and forth with China and Venezuela and all these other things? My next guests are here to help us about that. Jonathan B. Smith is in studio. Derek Gaunt is via Zoom. They're co-authors of Fight Less, Win More, How Master Negotiators Influence Hearts, Minds, and Deals. Guys, welcome to both of you. Jonathan, why don't you begin? Where'd you get your expertise in this area? Where'd you get this skill?
So I'm the business guy, but I'm the business coach for Chris Voss, who wrote a book called Never Split the Difference. And so I've trained with Chris for the last 10 years, learning the skills and being the practitioner of these negotiation skills.
So, and Derek, you along the way realized that you have to have an expertise. How would you frame out what people should start to begin to learn about to pick up your curriculum or your axioms?
Well, first thing, you got to open your mind. You have to be willing to experiment with something new. Jonathan always talks about staying curious. That is the biggest challenge for all of us, is staying curious. Stop being so married to our own agenda that we shut down our ability to listen to the other side. So it's a mindset shift. It's going into every conversation where something is hanging in the balance, where you say to yourself, this is not just about me. It's about the other side as well.
What about thinking, what do you want the outcome to be? Like, should you go into every conversation thinking about the outcome that you want, or are you listening to shape the conversation to get the best you can?
Well, we say no, never be so sure about what you want that you wouldn't take a better deal. So we walk into a negotiation looking for what we call black swans. Because there's going to be 3 to 5 things you didn't know about when you entered a conversation. And if you listen, you're more likely to get a better deal than you think.
So, like, let's say, for example, if to avoid arguing or escalating arguments with a spouse or a friend or a business partner, what would you say, Derek, are some things we should keep in mind?
First of all, you have to understand that if the words I want or I need is in your head, or in the head of the person with whom you're engaging, you are a threat to them. There's no way around that. You're a psychological threat to them. And if you are a psychological threat, that means that negative emotions and negative dynamics are present. If negative emotions and negative dynamics are present, what's supposed to be going on in the prefrontal cortex is being impeded. It's not, the brain is just not functioning at its maximum proficiency. And so they can't, air quotes, hear you. And realistically, what the conventional wisdom is, if I think someone can't hear me, then it's time for me to push harder, talk louder, explain more. And the more you do that, the more you reinforce those negative emotions and dynamics. So it's two rams on the side of a mountain banging their heads together.
But Derek, what you're saying is, yeah. I do know what I want in a conversation with you. I'm trying to buy that building from you. I do know what I want. Are you saying just don't use those words?
No.
Just use the different words.
What you want and what you need, you're going to put that on the back burner, and let's flip this script. And let's talk about what is the perspective of the other side. The minute that you can start to articulate my perspective with all that entails is the minute that you start to reduce your threatening status in my mind. The further you go down that rabbit hole, mm-hmm. the more threat you reduce, the smarter I get. Your brain works up to 31% more efficiently when you are in a positive state. So it's incumbent upon me to put you in a positive state. because I'm going to make my ask, to your point. Eventually, I'm going to get to what I want. And when I get there, I want you thinking as clearly as possible.
So, Jonathan, you've had 150 high-growth entrepreneurial companies, 1,500-plus sessions to help improve your strategy. You mentioned how long you studied on it. Derek, you have the law enforcement background, hostage negotiations. So I look at Capitol Hill today. And they don't compromise on anything. It's how quick they can get to reconciliation, or we shut down the government. Collectively, is it possible to change a mindset on both sides if in order to get some type of outcome? Because the outcome just seemed to be decided on election day, and then we wait until the next election.
Yeah, and they just seem to talk by each other.
Yeah.
And so we talk about levels of listening. And ideally, the two would be listening to each other for their point of view. Literally, if they could express to each other what their point of view is and feel heard, they would be more likely to be able to make a deal.
Right. So it's the way you approach the whole thing.
It's 100%. It's what we call staying curious, or what my mantra is, staying curious. And then beyond that, we use a technique called tactical empathy. So when we say tactical empathy, by our definition, is about them, not about us. Sympathy is about us. Empathy is about them. If they could actually express how their other party's feeling, they'd be more likely to get a deal.
Do I show empathy, Derek, in order just to get the best deal possible for me?
What you're talking about now is weaponizing empathy, and that's diametrically opposed to what we're talking about.
You want sincerity in the empathy.
If it's not sincere, it's going to stink. You are going to smell bad to the other side. You cannot hide being disingenuous.
So can I stop you there? You know, in sales,
yep.
What do I need? I need to get the sale. What do I need to do to get the sale? It's a negotiation. You're saying most sales is like, say what you need to say within reason in order to get that sale. That's the goal. What you're saying is whatever you say has got to be sincere, or else it's not going to work.
I don't want to work with a liar. I don't think you do. No one does. And if you and being selectively adherent to the truth is going to cause you problems down the road. It may work out for you in the short term. In the long term, that's going to come back to bite you in the rear. Mm-hmm. Because if I feel like you were just pushing your agenda and you took advantage of me, but I said yes anyway, you're setting yourself, you, Brian Kilmeade, are setting yourself up for me to revisit the same amount of pain on you that you visited on me during the course of this agreement.
Got it. Jonathan B. Smith is with me. Derek Gaunt, co-authors of Fight Less, Win More, How Master Negotiators Influence Hearts, Minds, and Deals. So let's go to you, Jonathan. I'm looking at the situation now in Greenland, where we have the President of the United States says, I want it. Denmark says, it's mine. We don't really do much with it. And we have allies coming in to show that they support Denmark. And they say they have started negotiations where both sides staked out their side. If you were to coach both sides, from what you know about this negotiation, what should be the mindset going in? Because nothing was really accomplished in the first round.
So the mindset is key to negotiation. Mindset is, how can I walk in and be open-minded and actually hear what the other party has to say? So it goes back to, are you listening to what the other party is saying? And ideally, can you listen in what we call level 5, listening for their point of view? What is their worldview?
Right. And when you understand that and don't like what they have to say, it's not going to help you achieve your goal, which is to get Greenland. Does your mindset or is your coaching say get the best deal possible?
So our mindset says we don't have to agree with what they have to say. We just have to have them understand we understand their position.
What do you get by understanding their position?
They hear us. People are desperate to be heard. If they don't feel heard, they're going to dig in. They're going to feel like you're a threat.
How do you show you're heard? How do you show? Like, would you say something to me and we're in a negotiation or we're in a disagreement? How do I show you that I'm listening?
Yeah. So one of the things we might do, which seems counterproductive, we call it an accusations audit. And one of the things with an accusations audit, we want to take the negative, whatever negative thing is in your head, I want to put it on the table.
So anticipate what you think is negative that I have out.
Yes. And I'm going to say it to you. for example, you think we're going to invade you tomorrow. That's now off the table because I've actually said it and acknowledged it. If they don't agree with me, the urge to correct is irresistible, and they'll say, no, that's not what I'm thinking. Otherwise, they'll say, that's right.
Mm-hmm. I noticed there's a couple of things going on right now when it comes to what's happening in Gaza, for example. And we've had these intense talks that got us to the point where there's peace. Now we're trying to get to the next phase. When you have something that's entrenched, Derek, and you know there's a history towards the animus, how do you coach that?
Let's go back to what Jonathan said. When we talk about sequencing this conversation, we're talking about shutting our mouths first. And I don't want to sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but listening at the deepest level. Why is that important? Because people all over the globe, we all have an undying need, an unquenchable thirst to be heard and to be understood. And most of us are not getting that anywhere on the globe. We're not getting it personally.
And we end up in a fight.
Professionally.
And we end up in a fight.
And we end up in a fight. This is how pervasive needing to be heard is. Just look at any comment section on YouTube for any video that's ever been put up. Somebody is going to say something off color about the content, and somebody who's a fan of the content is going to respond, and those two will go back and forth to each other ad nauseum. Why? Because even though they're in a fight, they got somebody who's listening to them. That is a need that we all have, and we would all be better served if we filled that need. So back to your original question, how do you coach that? First of all, it's a matter of sequencing the conversation. I'm going to start that conversation with a summary of the relationship from the beginning of time to right now, soup to nuts. Here's what we've gone through. And I'm going to punctuate that summary with a technique that we call labeling. As a result, you feel. Telling them what they feel as a result of the circumstances. And then I'm going to say to them, you have a vision. I know this to be a fact. You have a vision for what the next 1, 3 to 5 years is going to look like for, in this case, we're talking about Gaza. 1, 3, 5 years in Gaza, right?
Yep.
Would you be against walking me through that vision? And now I'm going to listen to what's important to Brian Kilmeade about Gaza. I'm going to be filtering it. Where does it line up with what my vision is for the next 1, 3, 5 years in Gaza? Where does it diverge? I'm going to put pins in that. And I'm going to continue to listen. And I'm going to continue to label. I'm going to continue to mirror. I'm going to continue to paraphrase everything that comes out of his mouth, paying particular attention to the things that benefit me. I'm going to hang a label on everything that benefits me because that's going to shore it up.
Right.
Because eventually I'm going to make my ask, and it's going to be harder for them to push back against me when I make my ask if they've already said that they are aligned in these particular areas.
All right. Jonathan Smith and Derek Hunt, stay right there. It's a few more minutes with you guys on the other end. And it's a topic I think we all can relate to. Fight less, win more. How master negotiators influence hearts, minds, and deals. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. More you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Go pick up the brand new book, Fight Less, Win More, How Master Negotiators Influence Hearts, Minds, and Deals in Your Life with Your Kids, with Your Spouse, if you're into foreign affairs with countries, or maybe with somebody in your life that's a Democrat or Republican and you're on the other side. How do you deal with them on everyday things or maybe even talk politics with them rather than just avoid it? Jonathan B. Smith and Derek Gaunt have made a career of that. And I'll start with you, Jonathan. You talk about low stakes deals. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so we say you have to do low stakes practice first, because when it's a high stakes situation, if you haven't done the low stakes practice, you will not own the skills.
Give me an example.
So an example is I fly into Vegas the other day early. It's like 10 o'clock. I know that I'm not supposed to check in until 3 o'clock. They may or may not have a room for me. I walk up to the desk and I said, I'm probably going to totally ruin your day. You know, you're probably going to think I'm another entitled person looking for something from you. So they're like, oh God, what could he possibly ask? And I go, how hard would it be for me to get a room early because I just came in from New York? Oh, no problem. Here, right. I have a room.
So why does that work? Why is that effective?
Well, I set them up for something that they, in their mind, they thought, God, what could he possibly be asking for? Is there a body somewhere that I'm going to have to deal with? And all I'm saying
is... So they think you're going to ask for the world.
They think I'm asking for the world.
And it's actually a lot less.
Yes.
So, Derek, how about with your kids? You're used to hostage negotiation where life and death's on the line. With your kids, I want you to put the iPad down, the iPhone down, the Xbox down. I keep telling you to, but every time I walk in the room, you got all three going.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
It's simple or as complex as the Gaza situation. You have to demonstrate for your child that you understand what the impact your ask is going to have on them. They may not be happy about it, but they're going to be much more receptive if you take the time to help them understand that you get this is not something that they want to do, that you get this is impeding their fun time, that you get that kids their age are all over 15 different devices at once, that you get they'd rather do that as opposed to eat or homework or go outside. And once you do that, you've given them a chance to sufficiently brace themselves for your ask. And that is the mountaintop of tactical empathy.
So, Derek, as a parent, I'm in control. Maybe everybody else I talk to, I'm equal. I'm equal with that receptionist. I'm equal with that country. But I'm a parent. So you really got to do what I say. So how will you be a parent and do that, too, and still keep your credibility? Yeah. You don't want to be a friend. You don't want to be your son's buddy.
Yeah. No, I get that. You've got the power. You've got the authority. You've got the leverage. Why do you have to wield it? They know that. This is no different. What you're talking about, Brian, is no different than hostage takers that we dealt with. I had all of the resources available to me to negatively impact his environment anytime I wanted to. I was the authority. I was in charge. But I never carried myself like that. My ultimate goal and objective was to have him put the gun down, release the hostages, and then ultimately submit to authority. Something, by the way, that every one of them say they're not going to do. And I get them to that point because I didn't push my agenda first. I never called inside that crisis site and said to them, hey, Brian Kilmeade, it's Derek Gaunt with the police department. I want you to put the gun down and come out. I never started a phone call like that. Why? Because he's not ready to hear it. Could I have? Could I introduce gas into that building and rock his world? Yeah, of course I could. But I never carried myself like that. So you can have the authority and the leverage over the other side. But how great is that when you put your wants and needs on the backseat and you focus on them first?
Guys, fascinating stuff. I need another 5 hours. But until then, pick up the book, Fight Less, Win More, How Master Negotiators Influence Hearts, Minds, and Deals. Derek Gaunt, Jonathan B. Smith, thanks so much, guys. Continue
thanks,
success.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't go anywhere.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. A big hour, a lot to discuss, a lot of moving parts, and of course, the continued unrest in Minneapolis. This hour, we're going to have a lot of great guests at the bottom of the hour. Jennifer Griffin from the Pentagon will be joining us. And Roger Zackheim is standing by, Washington director of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation Institute. And we're going to talk about the defense budget, which everybody's happy about. But some people told me on the right that it'll be trouble passing. He wants to go from $900 billion to $1.5 trillion. And as he told the media, as he told the military men and women I was with in Germany and Wiesbaden, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, he said, I'm getting you $600 billion. You need it, and we need the Golden Dome. So I will talk to him about that in a moment, as well as the Reagan economy. When Reagan, people have forgotten, when Reagan got started, he was so radical, viewed so radical in his economic principles. He was dealing double-digit interest rates. The debt wasn't nearly as bad, but unemployment was double what it is right now. There was a sense in this country, we're still on the hangover from Vietnam. There was a lack of pride, a lack of swagger, and he rebuilt the military and rebuilt our economy at the same time. But for a while, everybody wobbled and thought, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. And the advice to many people in the Reagan circles now to Trump, stay the course. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
We've had data since the turn of about 2002 was when the first one-to-one laptop program really started. And that was almost the exact same time we saw a downturn in basically every cognitive skill in the next generation. So believe it or not, Gen Z is the first generation in recorded history to be scoring less and lower.
Unbelievable, right? Are we at the breaking point with social media and with the iPad and the iPhones? They've already hurt a generation. Are we going to let it happen to another? We'll talk about it.
Number two.
In addition to the gross human rights abuses, in addition to its illegal march towards a nuclear weapon, the bombing attack on the United States Embassy in Beirut, killing 17 Americans and scores of Lebanese civilians.
That is Mike Waltz. Next step in is the most critical in Iran, as the evil regime seems to want to kill their way out of the unrest. Trump is showing support. But why his allies in the region say attacking Iran might be counterproductive.
Number one.
What we want to do is continue this Title VIII mission legally, ethically, morally, and peacefully, and remove those bad people and bad things from the streets. We say this time and again, but it seems to fall on deaf ears.
That is Greg Bovino, who runs ICE. Minneapolis on the brink as attacks on ICE not only don't slow down, they pick up. Now they're targeting the FBI. The left-wing radical leaders, the mayors, the attorney general, the governor, Waltz, have made things epically worse, and they have failed epically because of it. And I just, what I'm seeing, I'm just so horrified by what's going on. I'm going to bring up one incident before I bring in Roger. So, two nights ago, there was a shooting for a second straight night. We know about the death of this woman who tried to run over an ICE agent, and he has internal bleeding still. He was pulled out of duty just for his own security. So many death threats. She died, two bullets. She went to run over him. That's what happened. Let them investigate and find out who's at fault. For me, if you try to run me over with a car and I'm a police officer, I have a right to live my life, right? Especially when I was just dragged by a car, illegal immigrant. 1 month ago. So before I get to Roger, just let me just tell you what happened. The ICE agent spotted a illegal immigrant criminal. He went in pursuit. They ran. And finally, he turned around and starts confronting the ICE officer, and they start brawling. When the brawl starts happening, two others, what turned out to be illegal immigrant criminals, come running out of their apartments and start beating the ICE agent with shovels and brooms and fists. He takes out a gun, shoots one in the leg. He gets some help. All three get arrested. All three wanted illegal immigrant criminals. And the riots picked up. Nobody's thankful that they're off the streets. No one's regretful that they're allowed to live there. It's the ICE agent's fault. On what planet is it the ICE agent's fault? I had to get that off my chest. Roger, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Brian.
First off, the president's got it set for a midterm. And right now, there's economic indicators that are positive, but the inflation's at 2.7%. You guys, the Reagan had it during his years, was double that at this time. The unemployment was double what it was this time. People were saying that maybe it doesn't work. If Reagan was around right now, I imagine his message to Trump as he tries to reorganize trade and reinvigorate our economy, become more producers, exporters than importers, his advice might be stay the course.
Yeah, and I think President Reagan did what President Trump's trying to do, particularly on taxes, the big, beautiful bill.
Yep.
We're going to see the benefit from that play out as we march towards the midterm elections. That's probably the greatest parallel on the economic front in terms of confronting the economic challenges. And then, as you know, you were talking about the intro, it's combined with investment in our security. I mean, the security of the United States leads to the prosperity as well. So it's both a military rebuild and a rebuild of our economy. And it's really exciting. The technology is there. We're seeing a renaissance focus on manufacturing in the United States. These things will complement each other. As long as we're focusing on who the adversary is, right, and competing against China, who, of course, undermines not only our security, but our economic interests, and then really investing in the United States and allies and partners, that's a recipe for success.
We have, I'm not leading the country's economic policy. I understand that. But one thing is pretty clear. China doesn't buy anything. They're not consumers. They're all worried about their future. They don't have any faith in their government. They have no social safety net. So their only way of survival is to be mass exporters and dump cheap goods built by cheap labor everywhere in the world. We are consumers, and now the president wants to make us producers. So that's the advantage that we have. We buy stuff, we make stuff, he wants us to make stuff, and they want us to sell stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the subsidies of the Chinese government for their manufacturing at home, has been covered widely. We saw that during COVID, how it undermined our security, whether you're talking about pharmaceuticals or some, just basic masks, right? So that is something that really shocked the system in the United States, and we're seeing the reaction now. You know, American farmers need to export their goods. The soybeans need to get out. And so there is a tension point there. But when we talk about what's going to leap the United States economic growth to a $40 trillion economy that President Trump is focused on, right, and that is around technology and AI, we can't be dependent on the People's Republic of China. We can't be dependent on communists. And I think we're seeing a lot of progress on that front, and we need to continue to invest.
And the rare earth, this is something that Ronald Reagan didn't have to deal with at this level. But now without the rare earth and the precious metals, we're going to always have to worry about what China will always have control over the West. So we're having a massive push to collect as much as possible. Emergency conferences are taking place over the weekend. This is a late wake-up call, but so necessary. I talked to somebody who says within 18 months we can make real progress. So they would not be able to say, hey, you know what? I don't think we're going to export any more lithium or graphite or the precious metals needed to run our phones and to run our technology and to run our weapons.
No question about that. A lot's been done already, actually. We knew about this problem for a while now. President Trump is actually investing and taking ownership within U.S. companies is a controversial matter, certainly for Reaganites. But I think in this area, it's one that makes a lot of sense. We've seen government already this past year in President Trump's first year of his second term, making those investments and catalyzing some independence and reducing the dependency there. And that's part of this $1.5 trillion defense budget, right? Part of it is the manufacturing base, the industrial base, making sure that we are, bringing that home, onshoring and friendshoring, and certainly not being dependent on adversaries.
So, Roger, over the Clinton years, and maybe it was an earnest effort. They said it'll be a lot easier if you guys consolidated, kind of merged together. So we're not going to have these, so spread out our rebuilding our military or whatever type of military equipment we have. It hasn't worked. Because now there's no pressure for them to do things on time, and there's not enough time into R&D. But what I've understand is really happened is the Andurils, the Palantirs, and the other companies have come out of Silicon Valley and this new AI boom to really push the Raytheons of the world. And it's going to be for the better, and it's happening now.
That's exactly right. I mean, what you're talking about is competition and a free market. Right, we get the best outcomes when you have a competitive free market. We have new entrants, new technology. You know, for a long time, we thought innovation came out of the Pentagon, that five-sided building. What we've seen over the past decade is recognition that the technology innovation that's happening outside the Pentagon is actually the place we need to be, and the Pentagon and the military wasn't leveraging that. So, between the stories of Venezuela and Iran, we've actually lost a major storyline, which is President Trump has recognized that with a capital infusion into the defense industrial base, we'll be able not only to take care of the problems that we're facing today, be it in the Pacific, the Middle East, dealing with Iran and Venezuela, but frankly, we're having difficulty getting after all three of them simultaneously, right, will make an investment that will increase the force structure of our military for today and for tomorrow, including those those companies and technologies that you're referencing. They will compete for it. We need to be able to have aircraft carriers, but also drones that can operate on the contact line of the battlefield, like you're seeing in Ukraine, and also go ahead and pilot with manned systems up in the air with like our fifth generation fighters. There's a lot that has to be done, and this capital infusion will get us there. President Trump has an opportunity, Brian, to rebuild the military in a fashion that President Reagan did back, you know, almost 40 years ago.
Roger Zackheim with us, the Washington director of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Roger, I'll tell you, I was with thousands of, I've talked to so many of our men and women in uniform, all walks of life. I saw some 22-year-olds, and I was flying on a helicopter for, excuse me, on a plane with three 50-year-olds. I've never seen such spirit in the military. You know, some people, everyone, they're human beings. They're going to have bad days and miss their family, or the family's not there, or there's something going on. I get it. But there's such a sense of purpose among, I left the Army base thinking they all have a sense of purpose. And I really think this is a good time to be in the military. There's a lot of pride there, especially just knowing a few years ago the depths of Afghanistan and how bad everyone felt it. You know, the people that lost their lives and or lost so much in Afghanistan. I really feel that this has changed now. Am I wrong?
No, you're hitting on something really important. It really partners with the defense budget we were just talking about. And that is the military has been suffering and the country has been suffering from what people call, and I think it's right, Iraq syndrome. It's sort of similar to the Vietnam syndrome back in the Carter years. And that is America thought our military couldn't win anymore. And we treated our military not as warriors, but as sort of injured persons that needed our sympathy. The people in the military are professionals. They are trained, and they're trained to win. And as long as our political leaders and the country gets behind them, gives them an opportunity to win, they will do that. And that's what we've seen in Venezuela. That's what we've seen in Iran. And that's why you're seeing the recruiting numbers going up and the pride in the military go up. So it all connects, right? And these people that are carrying out these operations and winning have actually slayed this ridiculous notion, this binary choice, Brian, that you could only win if you have boots on the ground, you know, some big rebuilding campaign like Iraq and Afghanistan, or if you don't do anything at all. And that's a false choice. And we're seeing that our military is trained and they can carry out operations with precision and lethality. And that's what it takes to win. They're doing it.
So I want you to hear what Jack Keane, General Jack Keane, four-star general, retired, who does the Institute for Study of War. We know the next challenge is Iran, for now, that we have challenges. Mm-hmm. And this problem since 1979, this is the one that President Reagan inherited, dealt with for 8 years, got the hostages back. We had to deal with other things since that time, and they are the evil, and probably the most evil regime left on the planet. Here's what he said is next, because the president has pledged these protesters that he's got their back, essentially. Cut 23.
What is likely taking place and what could take place? Well, first of all, we're trying to squeeze Iran in terms of its ability to sell more oil that it's been selling. That has taken place. That's not decisive in itself, but it's an enabler. We're likely helping the protesters communicate better, given the Iranians have shut down the internet. And that's a covert operation to do something like that. Cyber operations likely being conducted against Iranians' command and control systems, their telecommunications, their ability for the IRGC and the Basi militia who are on the streets to communicate effectively. Also, cyber operations against their surveillance capability of the population itself.
He's not looking at land forces. We don't have all the assets maybe we need to do this, but it looks like stuff's going on right now.
Well, General Keane is a hero. And he's got tremendous strategic sensibility. And there's a lot that can happen, as he referenced there. I mean, imagine, Brian, if our cyber operators were able to open up the internet in Iran. And I think they have the capability and capacity to do so. So the whole world can see this murderous regime. And we're not relying on these little snippets coming out. And those protesting, those freedom people fighting for their freedom could communicate. And at the same time, listen, our military, you have 11 carrier groups. We have a lot going on. We have the blockade in Venezuela. We have to deter China against taking Taiwan. And so we're waiting for a carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, to come over to the Middle East. So I think what's happening here is that President Trump is sort of setting the table, adding the pressure with every passing day on behalf of the people of Iran countering this murderous regime. And I think Jack Keane has it right.
Yep. Roger Zackheim, thanks so much. The Washington Director for the Reagan Institute. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
You got it. When we come back, we have some time for your calls. And then Jennifer Griffin joins us from Washington. Don't move.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I don't use that language. I don't think it's appropriate to use that language. Will you condemn, though, the fact that the only conversation you're having about immigrants is them being violent criminals? What about the immigrants who are creating small businesses? What about the immigrants who are creating jobs? What about the immigrants who are contributing to the country?
What is wrong with Ro Khanna? He's smarter than that. Everyone loves immigrant story. We all have an immigrant story. That's a legal immigrant story. You have an illegal immigrant story where they come here illegally and they open up a business, probably under a false name with a manufactured Social Security number with the tax ID that doesn't exist. Okay, that's a great story. All illegal. Nothing I want to laud. But you want to talk about immigrant stories? We could do that all day. Do you know anybody that could say outside the Pilgrims? No, the Pilgrims can't even do it. I mean, even if you date back to the Pilgrims, if your ancestors, you're basically all immigrants. But it's the illegal immigrants who break our laws to get here. And then when they get here, they break our laws once here and then run rampant and come back multiple times. Ro Khanna, nobody has anything against immigrants. Especially if you live anywhere in America, you have first generations, your kids go to school, there's always a kid coming from another country. Nobody has anything against these kids. It's the illegal immigrants that come here, dump their kids into our schools for free, don't pay anything into it. Then we got to put extra facilities in there for English as a second language. And knowing they broke our laws, didn't have our fees, and now our social safety network props them up. And what this administration is doing is rebalancing, getting the illegals out, and I think they should be expediting the legal ways to get in. And also, I have no problem H-1B visas, maybe making sure the first-round draft picks are enticed to stay, because it helps our country. I'll be talking about that Sunday, 10 o'clock on One Nation, right here on Fox News Channel.
That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Bottom line is Iran's partners and proxies with Iranian weaponry, documented by the United Nations Yemen panel of experts, have repeatedly attacked our partners in the Gulf and attempted to damage global energy infrastructure. And then finally, the Iranian regime state television amplifies calls for a, quote, one bomb solution to wipe Israel off the map, which ironically would be not only a massacre of all Israelis, but also the Palestinian people whom the regime claims to support.
That is so smart to put that together. It's so great to have a UN ambassador like Michael Waltz who could fight wars, goes to wars, cover wars, politicians, and also knows how the White House works. We're going to have Jennifer Griffin shortly. But he was just talking about this is the tact of this Iranian regime, as evil as it gets. And keep in mind, too, that I'm just stunned that there's nobody out here on the streets protesting the point-blank assassinations of thousands of innocent people who are rising up just for an ounce of freedom. You would think in America there'd be people who fight for freedom. Maybe there might be a famous billionaire that says there's the repressed people of Iran need some supporters on 42nd Street and Times Square. I'm going to pay you $100 an hour to go out there for 4 hours and chant for the people of Iran who have the courage to stand up against the Ayatollah, an 86-year-old evil pretend cleric who has done nothing but finance terror throughout the region, and he has got no friends.
I mean, you could count on one hand the amount of people that even deal with Iran on a regular basis, even though many of these so-called enemies and rivals are calling on the U.S. not to take action, that we could make things worse. Here's more from Michael Waltz.
In addition to the gross human rights abuses, in addition to its illegal march towards a nuclear weapon,
yeah.
In 1979, the regime we now know, led by Ayatollah Khomeini, gave support to radical students who attacked the United States Embassy in Tehran, took over 50 Americans hostage, and held them in captivity for over 400 days. That was followed by the bombing attack on the United States Embassy in Beirut, killing 17 Americans and scores of Lebanese civilians, followed by the supported and directed direction of terrorists who drove two trucks filled with explosives into U.S. and French barracks in Beirut, killing 241 American soldiers and 58 French military personnel, all part of a multinational force invited by the Lebanese government. It's responsible for the deaths of over 600 American service members and countless others in Iraq.
And that number is likely higher. Ambassador Mike Waltz outlining Iran's track record as they begin to just try to kill themselves out of this threat to their government. Just randomly shooting people on the streets. The video is available, even though it's spotty. You're getting video out there of just people being shot in the head from close range, assassinated, put into body bags as they pile up. They are charged. Get this. They are charging families if when they come to pick up the body for the bullets they use to kill their loved ones. I mean, that's how evil this regime is. But what should be the next step, and what are we capable of doing to help the people who are rising up in the streets and at the same time not trying to get involved in an overseas conflict? Jennifer Griffin joins us now. Few people know the military, its capabilities, and the region better than you, Jennifer. As you join us from Washington, do you get the sense that the president wants to act? They just haven't settled how to act?
I get the sense, Brian, that the president was presented military options, and I think that those military options, given the fact that a lot of resources had been pulled out of the Middle East after last summer's strike on the nuclear program in Iran, the USS Ford, the aircraft carrier strike group, was moved to the Caribbean to help with Venezuela. There was no aircraft carrier in the region. That is a gap that we haven't seen for years, really. There were also missile defense systems that were taken out of the region because a lot of interceptors had been used. Those interceptors have not been replaced. The industry has had a hard time producing enough because of last summer's events and the attacks on the Houthis. So the military, while we have 30,000 troops in the Middle East, we have numerous bases. A lot of those bases are pretty vulnerable to follow-on attacks by Iran. Iran still has a very hefty ballistic missile program. And I think the president wasn't able to receive assurances that both Israel and the U.S. bases would be safe if the U.S. were to launch a strike and not have all of its air defenses and its military in position. So I think what we're seeing is a pause. I think the president used the strength of the threat to get the regime to stop the hangings, at least for now. And maybe they're keeping a lower profile in terms of simply gunning down people in the streets, which they were doing before. Will it stop and will the protests stop? It's very hard to get information out of Tehran today to know for certain what is happening. There's a lot of propaganda on both sides, a lot of psyops and information operations that it's really hard for us to know exactly what's happening. Mm-hmm. I think we'll know if the regime starts up again. There's no way that they can keep a lid on what's happening, and their economy is in a free fall. The people are angry, but they're also scared right now. The tactics that they're using to control the people in cities across Iran are very, very, very barbaric and terrible. So it's a wait and see, but I would keep an eye on when a U.S. aircraft carrier arrives in the Middle East. But I'm also told by very well-placed sources in the military that if the president were to act in the future and use the military, it would look very different than last summer. This is not going to be a few pinprick strikes. This would be something much bigger, swifter, and the president wants assurances that it will not spread into a wider Middle East war.
So interesting. President Trump in the Wall Street Journal was advised, according to them, that a large-scale strike against Iran was unlikely to make the government fall and could spark a wider conflict. Your thoughts on that, and also the fact that the Gulf allies reportedly are trying to persuade the president not to act?
I think it's based on all the experts I've spoken to, and I spoke with Norm Rule yesterday, who served in the CIA for 34 years, and his focus was on Iran. He is probably the foremost expert on Iran in our intelligence community. And he said that anyone who thinks that a single or even just a limited military strike on the regime would cause it to fall is fooling themselves. It's not to say that, that military action can't have some effect in terms of destabilizing the regime, but you're going to have to use other mechanisms, including cyber, including information operations, including the banking system, the sanctions enforcement. The administration is doing some things very well, and that is the targeting of these oil tankers, which is the shadow fleet, which basically helps fund the Iranian regime. That is very significant. That nobody's getting killed in those the use of the U.S. Coast Guard and the Navy to and the special operations to take those oil tankers. They've taken about five of them now, and that is now they're about 1,500 in this ghost fleet, but that is having an impact. The banking system is collapsing in. You're seeing a flight of capital, according to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. The leaders are, you know, it's unstable. And as we've seen with the fall of the Berlin Wall and other situations, these things can change quickly. And I don't think we know, this is not over. And I don't think we know how this ends. But I also think that if the U.S. military goes to war and you know, decapitates the Iranian leadership and regime, you don't know what comes next. And civil war, as we saw in other countries, it could get very bloody. It could spread to other countries. And that's why we've heard caution, not just from Arab allies, where we have our bases. Remember, our bases are in Qatar, in UAE, in Bahrain, but also from Israel. Israel is, and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is very concerned about what comes next. Now, Bibi Netanyahu did want the president to focus on the ballistic missiles because Iran has been producing more and building up its stockpile again, and they have mobile missile launchers that are very hard to take out. And so Netanyahu did appeal to the president that that you know something needs to be done about these missile launchers and the missiles, but it doesn't mean again this is going to be a very complicated action if the military gets involved. But the threat of having the military on the horizon is giving the president leverage with the regime. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
Right. General Jack Keane joined us earlier on Fox and Friends. Cut 27.
This is a process that's taken place. We're focused on holding the people accountable for what they have done and then putting it on a pathway to so weaken the regime, which is already politically, economically, and military the weakest it has been in 45 years. Our actions here will further weaken it.
So we look at a regime that has their currency devalued massively. Inflation is skyrocketing. They can't get water into their capital city. And now they know that billions is going to Hezbollah still and millions to Hamas. So that's that. It seems like economics might have been the reason for the uprising to begin with.
Well, it's interesting. There was a very good piece in the Wall Street Journal about the bank that was being used by many members of the IRGC and the leadership and the national and the security services. And that bank failed back in December, and it really had a ripple effect. More banks are likely to fail. The situation with the currency, I think it's been devalued by 80%. I think that inflation's at 25%. But remember, these these kind of tyrants and these regimes, you can have that happen, whether it's North Korea. Even Venezuela was able to hang on until the U.S. military went and grabbed President Maduro. They've had, you know, huge inflation and devalued currency for a long time, and these regimes can hang on. They have the bullets, and that is what is challenging, is that even the military targets that the U.S. could take out, they could destabilize the regime, but it doesn't. It's still going to take the Iranian people overthrowing this regime.
It is. And if we can't do it, because we don't want to own it, we do not want to finance it, certainly. So I have the numbers, 18,400 arrests, 2,600 dead. Do you think that is those some of the numbers that you hear?
I mean, that's what I'm hearing, but I don't think anyone knows, Brian. I think that there are a lot of Iranian opposition groups who are outside the country who are getting information, piecemeal information. It's certainly in their interest to give, you know, the highest numbers, but then there are also indications that there are leaks from the National Security Establishment of Iran that put it at about, I think, 2,000 dead. But again, I don't think we know, and I think my guess is it's in the thousands. Based on the videos that we've seen and the approach that they've been taking, this is like nothing we've seen in 45 years. There have been other uprisings. There have been other brutal crackdowns. This is different. And what Norm Rule told me is that it's coming faster and faster. So you had the 2009 Green Revolution. Then, you know, in 2020 and 22, it seems like the periodicity of these uprisings are coming faster and faster, given the shaky standing that the regime has on. And don't forget that last summer's attacks really pulled the curtain back on what is really like a Wizard of Oz situation for the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and the rest of that establishment. They could not protect Iran from those strikes, and that was another sign that the regime is not all powerful.
The quality of that operation in Venezuela really sent a message in that region and around the world. I mean, we don't know how it's all going to play out. But the way that was pulled off.
We're in a historic moment. Yeah. We're in a historic moment, and all of these pieces are interconnected, and we don't know how all this is going to impact Russia and Putin, because Russia is losing a lot of its proxy estates that have helped prop up the regime with their petrodollars, and that has been the only reason they've been able to continue in Ukraine. And so it's all interrelated, and it's going to take a little bit of time. Americans tend to be very, want immediate results. This, I think, we should watch carefully, but it's not over. And the U.S. is playing a responsible role here. And this is the way the U.S. military should be used, as a backup to make sure that the president's word is listened to. But you don't go in guns blazing when you haven't protected your bases, you haven't protected your troops, you have to think of the unintended consequences and the follow-on effects. And I think the president is weighing those very carefully.
And lastly, real quick, Jennifer, it looks like China's allies are realizing their relationship has limits. Look at Venezuela and look at Iran, right? They didn't really do anything after Iran was hit in June, and they're not really doing anything now.
Absolutely. And, you know, the only thing I would say is that I think the only way to take on places like Putin and China and Beijing is with allies. And right now, some of those alliances are strained because of some of the rhetoric coming out of Washington and the administration. And I think alliances and allies, that is going to be the best way to push back on Putin and Xi in this kind of era of great power competition.
I hear you. Jennifer Griffin, always great. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. From Washington, that's the latest on a very perilous situation in the Middle East. It's Brian Kilmeade Show.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Gen Z is the first generation in modern history to underperform us on basically every cognitive measure we have, from basic attention to memory to literacy to numeracy to executive functioning to even general IQ, even though they go to more school than we do. So why? What happened? What happened around 2010 that decoupled schooling from cognitive development?
And the answer is the iPhone, the smartphone, the iPad. And they started bringing in Chromebooks and others into schools, grammar schools, high schools. Get people ready. Get them used to the computer world. Be part of it. And what happened is the whole writing things down, figuring things out on your own, the writing to brain to learning from the pen to the brain, there's something about that that we found out later. It's important to write notes out as opposed to, and a lot of people have found that in the real life now, that even though you can type it out, you're better off writing it out. So all that stuff just disappeared. People weren't memorizing things they were doing in school. And now the social media distraction and the lack of patience and attention span all combined to destroy Gen Z. And that was part of a panel yesterday, on Thursday, on Capitol Hill, that talked about all this. And there's no more universal thing that you could put up there. If you notice, in the poorest neighborhoods and the richest neighborhoods, everyone's got an iPhone. You can watch video in Africa. Unless it's really, really impoverished, they have iPhones. So they're all subjected to all the social media and the learning devices and the hindrances. Not many people went into it, their eyes wide open, hoping for the best. Well, we have learned enough to know we got to change things. So Australia said, we're just banning all social media until 16. All these apps, take them off your phone. I don't know how they're going to enforce it, but they're doing it right now. Should we follow? I think so.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here, finishing up the final hour, one of the final hours of the week here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're there. It's been an exciting week, a lot going on, a lot pending. And of course, the backdrop is we're in election year. It's no longer okay to say, oh, don't worry about it. Don't get ahead of the game. This is an election year. And at stake is really the last 2 years of the Trump administration that he can do a lot of massive things. And that is if he loses the House. He's got about 3 or 4 cushion lead in the Senate. I think it's secure, but it's going to be a fight. There's a lot of tough seats. And a lot has to do with how the economy rolls and what's happening overseas and what's happening in our cities, which brings us to the big three.
Number three.
We've had data since the turn of about 2002 was when the first one-to-one laptop program really started. And that was almost the exact same time we saw a downturn in basically every cognitive skill in the next generation. So believe it or not, Gen Z is the first generation in recorded history to be scoring less in lower.
And you can blame the iPad, the iPhone, all of that, and the social media apps. And the way we thought it would be better for kids to learn with Chromebooks in schools, it is blown up in our face. Are we going to fix it?
Number two.
In addition to the gross human rights abuses, in addition to its illegal march towards a nuclear weapon, the bombing attack on the United States Embassy in Beirut, killing 17 Americans and scores of Lebanese civilians.
That is Michael Waltz, the ambassador to the United Nations. Next step and is the most critical as Iran, that evil regime, seems to want to kill their way out of this tumult. Trump is showing support, but what are his options? We'll talk about it.
Number one.
What we want to do is continue this Title VIII mission legally, ethically, morally, and peacefully, and remove those bad people and bad things from the streets. We say this time and again, yep. But it seems to fall on deaf ears.
Yep, because 51% of the country, according to CNN, thinks it makes cities less safe. I actually am not one of them. I know they're keeping people safe by getting rid of illegal immigrants, illegal immigrant criminals. Minneapolis on the brink as attacks on ICE now and the FBI continue in that city, led by two left-wing radicals, one mayor, one governor, who are epically failing before our eyes again. Shannon Bream joins us now. Shannon, we're likely to get more scenes tonight. And over the weekend, all day and night, because their mayor and governor in Minneapolis and their financiers want them to riot against ICE. How does this end?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the president talking about
you know, invoking the Insurrection Act, which would have to say essentially the state can't handle the situation. Law enforcement there, their judicial court system there can't handle it. Well, their Attorney General Keith Ellison said, we are handling it. And if you try to use the Insurrection Act, we will see you in court. So neither side seems to be backing down from their position. While, you know, there are some calls for let's tone it down, let's have peace. At the same time, that's followed up with, and be sure to go out and film ICE and get in their faces and do everything you can short of committing a crime. So this weekend could be really difficult.
It could be. And just so the Insurrection Act, do you think legally there's something there that the president could reach to? Certainly there's anarchy in the streets.
Yeah, and I definitely think that, you know, listen, I think his legal team will give him good advice on that. And they say that they'll give him all perspectives so he can make a good decision. I think that depending on the judge it lands in front of, if indeed the attorney general up there does take this to court, the judge's perception of it, of course, on that first step is always going to be a big determining factor. But I think that they can make arguments legitimately that this situation feels out of control, that local law enforcement isn't able to keep things under control, at least in these bigger, wider spread, more provocative demonstrations that are going on. And it may be up to Minnesota to show that they do have it under control. And, you know, that will be their defense.
So here is Governor Tim Walz, the day of the shooting. Tell me if he makes things better or worse. Cut four.
We do not need any further help from the federal government. To Donald Trump and Kristi Noem, you've done enough. There's nothing more important than Minnesotan safety. I've issued a warning order to prepare the Minnesota National Guard. We have soldiers in training and prepared to be deployed if necessary.
So he's done enough. You can go home. That's after the shooting over the weekend, even though now it's emerged over the last few days, even though now it's emerged. She hit him with a car and he has internal bleeding. I'm talking about the ICE agent. Mm-hmm. Now listen to this. Cut five from yesterday.
You're angry. I'm angry. Angry's not a strong enough word, but we must remain peaceful.
Right. So here's Mayor Fry. Then cut six.
And I have a message for ICE. To ICE, get the out of Minneapolis.
And then Wednesday, cut
seven. We do not want you here. Show me a single place where I have encouraged anything other than peace. Show me a single place where we have encouraged violence. I have said from the get-go to people in Minneapolis, do not take the bait. We are better than that.
What does we need to debate? How about march and protest? Don't attack cops. Mm-hmm. Nobody's listening to you. And number two, get out. Just actually radicalizes people. And we're seeing the reaction. And here's the crazy thing, Shannon. There's no cops anywhere. There's no arrests. How do you not have arrests after we see them taking mm-hmm. over FBI vehicles, hindering ICE, attacking ICE agents?
Yeah, and that may be part of the president's argument. Your local law enforcement isn't handling it. They aren't able to handle it. I mean, that may be the very argument he makes for trying to invoke the Insurrection Act. But when you have leaders who stand up and say, get the F out, that signals to people that ICE is doing something unlawful, that they don't belong there. They're doing something immoral or unethical. And what signal does that send to people? Okay, then you're right to go and protest against them and to push back physically. A lot of people are going to interpret that in their brain when they hear that message. You see the folks that are out there each night. You hear them chanting Nazi. If you really thought Nazis were running rampant through your city, you would say, oh, I should go stop them.
Yeah.
This is a bad thing. And so if you're being told that these people are Nazis, that message from your leadership, whether it's local, state, whatever it is that you're right to oppose them in whatever means you feel necessary.
So let's talk about what's happening over the weekend. You get the sense the president is going to do something in Iran. And when you see the horrible the thing about the president, when he sees personal carnage, if you say, well, 100 people died, but if he sees the video, if he sees the pictures, that's what gets him incensed. And now the video is everywhere. How these people, these Iranian protesters, just rising up because they have no water, the devaluing of their currency, the corruption in their government, the lack of freedom, whatever, put them into the streets, and now they're being executed from close range. You get the sense that Trump really wants to do something effective. The question is, what would work?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that is the big question, because these folks who are on the streets are looking at the United States, and what they've seen is just months ago, a precision strike at the commander-in-chief's command, President Trump, our military, going after Iran's nuclear program. They know that he will act. They believe him when he says,
hey, I'm looking out for you. Now, we also know there's a ton of lobbying from others in the region, Israel, Qatar, and other countries who are saying, whoa, 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 let's try to slow this thing down, and urging the president not to take kinetic military action. But you know, there are so many things we can be doing, you know, cyber attacks and other things that we may not know anything about that are actually potentially happening right now. So, you know, when the president sort of quieted down midweek about the public red lines and those kinds of things with Iran, a lot of people say, oh, you know, East Taco, he's not going to do anything. But remember, when the president goes quiet, very often, not too long after that, there is something major that happens. So we're standing by.
I think the cyber attack's happening right now, actually.
Yeah, could be.
I think there's no doubt about it. As USS Abraham Lincoln seems to be steaming into the area, it left Norfolk, I think, a couple of days ago. So we'll see. I mean, our military is our Navy's getting a workout. There's no question about that. And the other thing, Deem, is China. China is not happy about what happened in Venezuela. China's not happy. They're going to be boxed out one way or another from Greenland. And China loves this discounted oil it gets from Iran. And sanctions could be coming down from the Senate that the president now pledges to sign on anyone buying Russian oil. So our chief, I guess, superpower rivals are should be feeling the pressure.
Yeah, they should. And listen, this gets to kind of some of this point within the president's, you know, support among MAGA. They said, listen, we voted for this guy because we don't want to be in any foreign entanglements. We want to be out of wars, not starting wars. And the president's trying to say this is America first by, as you said, boxing out China, boxing out Russia, getting at our adversaries in ways that hurt them economically by getting involved with Venezuela and different places. And potentially he would even argue Greenland. I mean, he says these are America first things that are happening, that we're not going to be in long-term things with a lot of U.S. troops, you know, boots on the ground kind of thing. He's about these precision strikes, whether it's taking out Maduro, whether it's taking out Soleimani, or, you know, going after Iran's nuclear program. The world has to worry when President Trump says that he is going to take action. He's done it in a way that has to make our enemies think twice.
Shannon, what are you? Who do you have on Sunday?
We are going to have Senator John Cornyn with us, and from the other side of the aisle, we've got Congressman Jim Himes, who's a ranking member on ranking Democrat over on the House Intel Committee. We're going to talk about all this foreign policy, but we're also going to talk about domestic issues like the fact that we run out of money at the federal government in a couple weeks, and we could be having another government shutdown.
But we had an appropriations bill passed. I mean, the right way, regular order.
Some of them. Yeah.
So we have
a
lot more to do.
Regular order in D.C.
It would be great. So I look forward to...
What are you having on this weekend?
We got Mark Wayne Mullen. We have a rising star in the Republican Party, Eric Johnson, mayor of Dallas. We got Mike Lawler, who's not happy they didn't decide to extend subsidies on Obamacare. But keep in mind, too, the Wall Street Journal writes today that where's all the panic? Here we are, 2026, just about the same amount of people signed up as before, and the rates are roughly the same. So maybe it was a Democratic manufactured panic that the sky would fall if this happened. We're also going to have, I'm also going to have some more of my special of 3 days I spent in Germany in Wiesbaden. So the Clay Clay Cusern Army Base. So
you have a
more
nap coming up anytime in the next like 48 hours?
Might be in the break. Might be in the break.
You get like a 30 to 60 second nap. By the way, I am disappointed to hear that you're not having your dance off. I'm going to keep asking every week until you decide to have it.
So listen to this. I saw this story that people even at weddings are dancing less because guess why? Because
cameras, videos.
People keep on taking videos of them. So let's say you're not a professional dancer, and those videos go viral, and you look like Elaine Bennis on Seinfeld.
Right, which
so,
is me.
So people are saying, screw it, I don't need it. So how do you feel about that?
Here's the thing. When you're at a wedding, that's one of the places that you really, everybody can get up and dance and do their thing.
You think.
What gets me is the people who sit there on the sidelines and kind of just stare at everybody dancing or bring out their phones. But listen, I don't claim to be a good dancer, so I don't care. You're going to get
But you're enthusiastic.
I'm enthusiastic. You got to feel the music. Maybe you've had a glass of champagne. I don't know. You know, life is short. Dance.
Can I also add something else?
Please.
Why can't this generation come up with their own music? It's always the music that they love is Sweet Caroline. They're playing Freebird. I'm like, wait a second. Why are you tapping into my youth?
Get your own stuff.
Get your own youth.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah.
Yeah, because no one's listening, just us. Last year, well, I guess it would be 2024, 2 years ago, I was in London with a group of friends my age, and we decided to go to this 80s club, which was awesome, because it was all our music.
Right.
But everyone there was like 25.
Because they have
no
music.
At us, I'm like, we're the OGs, respect.
I know. No doubt about it. We lucked out. We didn't realize how lucky we were. Or everyone realizes, I can't do any better than that. And they're quitting.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. We peaked in the 80s. That's it. America, you're welcome.
All right. Thank you so much, Hannah Breen. We'll watch it all day Sunday.
Okay, bye.
You got it. Meanwhile, Ian O'Connor's coming up at the bottom of the hour, but your calls are next. 1-866-408-7669. Why would I bring on this premier writer now? And by the way, best-selling author, because he's got the scoop on John Harbaugh, the most sought-after coach available that I can remember over the last 20 years. I think I know where he's going, and so do you.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And one of the scariest things is, so with all these national and international tests, we know scores have been going down since 2002. But what we don't know, and what people, it's hard to find out, is that once tests go digital, so like PISA is an international test that went digital in 2015, NEEP went digital in like 2022. Anytime a test goes digital, scores drop significantly.
Wow.
It's just what we do is we use statistics to do what's called renorming, and we basically hide it. So if scores are getting worse, you can possibly add on another 5 to 10% worse. That's genuinely what's going on once we move on to screens. We just don't see it. Thank you, statistics.
So that is a hearing really beneficial to so many people at any walk of life, whether you're a parent, grandparent, or a kid. They were just looking at learning and why the numbers are dropping. Yet we're going to more school than ever. A lot of it has to do with the way we learn. And the way we learn is not in, really effectively is not through screens, not through Chromebooks. It is actually writing things with your hands, as well as the social media distraction and the ADD that come, the undiagnosed ADD that comes with always going to the world of Instagram and Snapchat and TikTok, which I don't get. So Ted Cruz is on the offensive here. Cut 28.
Children ages 8 to 12 now use screens an average of 5.5 hours each and every day. For teens, it's even higher, at 8 hours and 39 minutes each and every single day. Put another way, more than half of the time that a teenager is awake, he or she is staring at a screen. Parents intuitively know that excessive use of internet-connected devices like smartphones and tablets poses significant physical and mental health risks to children.
So that is Ted Cruz yesterday. So what do you do if you're in the middle of this? Cut 29.
In 2023, 1 out of 5 children had a mental or behavioral problem diagnosis. We've also seen significant increases in child and teen suicide rates. Something is very wrong. And I don't believe it is merely a coincidence, as our witnesses will discuss today, that these harms are rising alongside the early and excessive use of screens.
Right. And it's not just kids at home or at restaurants where parents can't handle them, so they just give them a screen. This is where sometimes they're learning, like, for example, the laptops in schools. Listen to Dr. Jared Cooney Horvath, a neurologist and author of Digital Delusion. Cut 35.
It's just straight data. We've had data since the turn of about 2002 was when the first one-to-one laptop program really started. So that's kind of the marker where we say tech really started entering schools. And that was almost the exact same time we saw a downturn in basically every cognitive skill in the next generation. So believe it or not, Gen Z is the first generation in recorded history to be scoring less and lower on their parents than on measures of memory, attention, general IQ, creative ability, critical thinking, you name it, everything turned. And the only thing we can draw it back to is this dang tool we brought into the classroom.
Yeah, that is, he's been on our show before, and I got so many comments about people saying how much they learned from Dr. Horvath because of the book that he wrote. He was just great, because what he's trying to say is, it's so easy to say, oh, these these devices getting you hooked, and I get that that's an issue too, or parents don't want to parent their kids. They let that iPhone keep their kids quiet so they could do what they want. That's another thing. But what about you go to school, and what about superintendents and directors and principals go, okay, for these kids to get them ready for real life, since they're going to work on a computer so much, let's all get them Chromebooks. Let's make get an iPad for everybody. We'll take it out of the budget. This way, kids can get used to a world in which it's less paper, more digital. But then you factor in a thing called learning, how you learn. And whatever happens, some people were well-meaning, no evil people, but we have to adjust to what we now know. Because sadly, the Gen Z seems to be the laboratory. We have to now live with the results and change.
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think this is the best day the Giants have had since they won the Super Bowl. That's their biggest win since they won their last Super Bowl. This is a man that if you just, like, looked at Harbaugh and you thought of adjectives to describe Harbaugh, you would say accomplished, established, stable, consistent, connected, leadership. This is an enormous hiring for the New York Giants. The New York Giants haven't had this level of an adult in the room, certainly since Tom Coughlin.
And there you go. That is ESPN, and that of that very familiar name, Dan Orlovsky. He is talking about the Giants possibly hiring as early as today, make the announcement that John Harbaugh is the next coach, where it is that it's $20 million a year for the next 5 years. Harbaugh will leave the Ravens after 18 years, and I cannot remember Giant fans happier than they are right now. Ian O'Connor knows all about an outstanding columnist with The Athletic, six-time New York Times bestseller, has been all over this story from day one. Ian, is there anything that could derail this?
I don't think so, Brian. They're still working through some things this morning. I would be very surprised at this point. Is it impossible it gets derailed? No, but it looks like they'll announce later today, and I think that Giants fans, I agree with Dan Orlovsky that this is the biggest hire. I actually think it's bigger than Tom Coughlin. I think when Coughlin got hired, the Giants were in the Super Bowl 4 years before that. The Giants have been losing here for 14 years for the most part. And to me, I've been covering sports in New York for four decades. This is the biggest hire the New York Giants have ever made in that time period.
You said you were talking to him and he used the word we when he was talking about the Giants?
John Harbaugh did, right. That was 2 days after he was fired. I talked to him on the phone, and I could tell, Brian, right then and there, he wanted to be the coach of the Giants. I understand that the Falcons and the Titans were in there, the Dolphins to some degree, maybe the Cleveland Browns. But to me, the Giants were far and away the leader in the clubhouse, and he just felt like it was a good fit. He likes the young quarterback, Jackson Dart, of the Giants. He likes some pieces on that roster. And he likes the idea of coaching for a storied franchise in the biggest market in the country. And he'll get that opportunity.
You asked him if you thought his brother might be interested in coming to the Giants. Well, and his answer was?
The New York Football Giants? Are you kidding me? So I knew then. That was 4 years ago. I knew then that John Harbaugh understood what it meant to coach a franchise like that in New York. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that once he was fired, I knew. And now, listen, even before he was fired, the Giants had him at the top of their list. They did some homework on him. They thought he might get let go, and they were right. But Harbaugh, who thought he was going to get another season in Baltimore, didn't. But before the end of the season, in case he got fired, he looked at some possible openings, and the Giants were at the top of his list, too. So it's a good fit, and obviously we'll see how it plays out.
So do you think if there wasn't talent on the roster, it would still be a good fit? Or, I mean, people look at the record, if they don't really follow the Giants, they think, well, it's another bad team. But there's talent on that roster. Do you think there's something about the roster that made it more attractive or just the legacy?
Jackson Dart. Well, the legacy matters to him. But if they didn't have a quarterback, I don't think he takes this job. The quarterback is everything. It's the quarterback and the head coach. When you have those two things, you get those two things right, you can win a lot of games. Look at Chicago this year. Ben Johnson, all of a sudden, they've got a chance to go the distance. Jacksonville this year. New England with Mike Vrabel. Once you get the coach right, as long as you have the quarterback in place, you can suddenly win a ton of games. I think the Giants next year, they were 4-13 this year. They've been terrible again for the most part for 14 years. If you told me next year, Brian, that they're 10-7 and a wild card in the playoffs, I think that's plausible as long as they complete the hire of Harbaugh, which I expect them to do today, and Jackson Dart stays healthy.
How do you say, think he gets along with the GM? I was talking to a friend of his that knows him well, coaches with him, and he says he does not want to be the general manager. But I'm sure he wants influence in the draft and personnel and free agent signings. How do you think that'll work?
Great way of putting it. He does not want to be the GM. He doesn't need total control of the roster. Remember, Brian, in Baltimore, he worked with Ozzie Newsome, one of the best GMs ever in the NFL. After Ozzie Newsome was done, Eric DaCosta steps in. He's one of the best GMs in the NFL today. And John had a good partnership with both of those executives. Now, was it perfect all the time? No, but it was a very productive partnership. That's what he's looking for here with Joe Shane. Joe Shane is 13-38 in his last 3 years as GM of the Giants. So there's some questions there. And certainly you don't bring in an 18-year winner and future Hall of Famer in John Harbaugh and not give him any say in terms of the construction of the roster. It doesn't make any sense. So my suspicion is that when they finalize terms, Harbaugh will have some control of the roster and some say over roster decisions, but I don't think he'll have total control.
Right, and no one doubts Joe Shane's very popular within the league and respected. If you've talked to other GMs, you talk to people, writers, you know, I know some picks he made, and everyone talks about the Hard Knocks and say letting Saquon go. But letting Saquon go looked bad last year, but not as bad this year. And then I remember talking to the commissioner of football when the Saquon thing went down. I was at the Al Smith dinner, and I talked to Roger Goodell, and he just casually mentioned, you know, the Giants at this point, you know, that's not really where they, you know, usually teams spend their money on the running back. They need so much. So it's not that bad of a deal. Like, I don't think he knew they were going to win the Super Bowl, but that's the way things fall. Maybe in showing flexibility on the cap. But looking around the other opening spots, Mike Tomlin says, I'm taking a year off, so that wipes him out. I hear Brian Daboll, the former Giant coach, is a contender for the Titan job.
I'm not sure he's going to get a head coaching job in this cycle, but I think he'll get a second chance in the league. His first year, as you remember, in New York, Daboll took the Giants to the playoffs. That maybe in some ways sort of set them up for failure because then they made decisions to try to go all in and the team wasn't there yet. And then that first year run to the playoffs with Shane as GM and Daboll as the head coach might have actually derailed that program in a strange way. But Brian Daboll will get another chance at some point. I think Stefanski will certainly get a job. I wouldn't be surprised in Pittsburgh if Brian Flores, who almost got the Giants job when Daboll got it, is the person who wins that derby with the Steelers to follow Mike Tomlin. Now, it's a tough act to follow. Guy never had a losing season in 19 years. But at the same time, fans were ready for Tomlin to go. Tomlin was ready to go. So that made sense. But I would see Flores as a very good possibility in Pittsburgh.
But isn't he suing the league for discrimination?
He is, yeah. So, but I don't believe the Steelers aren't cited in that lawsuit. The Giants were cited in that lawsuit because he felt they gave him a sham interview. I don't think it was a sham interview because I know John Mara actually personally reached out to Brian Flores and wanted him. If it were up to John Mara, Flores might have gotten the job, but Joe Shane wanted Brian Daboll. So I think that we'll see what happens with that lawsuit. If he gets the Steelers job, is it possible that suit goes away? Maybe. But I will say this. Flores is a great defensive coordinator. He is really, really one of the best I've ever seen. He did a pretty good job as the Miami head coach. He needed to work on a few things. His interpersonal relationships in the organization went a little sideways. But Flores, second time around as a head coach, I would bet on that.
What about Shula's grandson? Defensive coordinator of the Rams.
I was just talking to a colleague yesterday and saying that if I'm the Dolphins, and I understand that you don't want to hire someone because he's the grandson of Don Shula, but if you're the Miami Dolphins, that has to be awfully appealing, particularly since he's considered one of the best coordinators in the league and has Sean McVay's blessing. If I'm the Dolphins owner or general manager, Chris Shula to me, it's like the best of both worlds, and they don't have a quarterback. That's the problem. So they need a young coach to go in there and build that team and find a quarterback and and succeed long term with that person. But I would, if I'm the Dolphins, I would be very interested in Chris Shula.
So let's talk about this weekend. I think the game of the weekend, I think you're looking at, I'm very intrigued to see if Buffalo is going to live up to the hype. Buffalo is going to continue the momentum, and can Denver live up to the hype of that regular season? Because they were great, but they weren't dominant, Ian.
Right. I don't see a great team anywhere in this tournament. And I think this is the year for Buffalo to get to the Super Bowl. I think Josh Allen in the AFC side of the draw with no Mahomes this year, no Joe Burrow, no Lamar Jackson. This is Josh Allen's year to make a really serious run at winning a championship. He's too good a player, too tough a player to not win a Super Bowl. I wrote that earlier this year. And this is his moment. And I think he can go in there, and I think he will go in there and beat Denver. I think having won last week in Jacksonville, Denver sitting around as a number one seed, they earned their place at the top of the AFC, but they're sitting around and they're not a superpower by any stretch of the imagination. So I think Buffalo will win that game and maybe win the AFC championship the following week.
Well, but the best overall team that you see right now might be Seattle, but now Darnold's got an oblique issue, which I've had that, very similar athlete. I'm very similar caliber athlete to Sam Darnold. That people have compared me to him often, but I've had that, and he really can't move.
No, and I mean, just think of the torque you need, the rotation of your hips and everything else when you're a quarterback. You're planning and you're firing. And I've had oblique issues at times, and obviously we can't compare ourselves to NFL quarterbacks, but just think, and if you get hit when you're throwing the ball, man, it's going to hurt without question. Sam Darnold's a tough guy, so I think he'll hang in there and do the best he can, but that's going to be a very difficult assignment. I think Seattle will survive. I have Seattle going to the Super Bowl because I do think from the top of the roster to the bottom, they're the best team. And if I had to put $10 on it, I would say Buffalo versus Seattle in the Super Bowl. So I think they'll get through it, but that oblique injury does concern me.
I think America would love the Buffalo Bills story of failing so often, and that's such a likable quarterback, and he's really a throwback when the 70s, when a quarterback could win the game single-handedly. It reminds me of Elway. You know, Elway could just find a way in his prime and the years in which he lost, not so much at the end. So Bills, Broncos, you pick? Bills. The Texans, Patriots, you pick the Patriots, right?
I do.
49ers. If Darnold doesn't play, I don't think the 49ers lose. But
he'll play. He'll play.
Okay. And then you have Bears, Rams. Your thought?
I'll go with the Rams there. Stafford is probably the MVP of the league. And listen, that's a very interesting game. I could see that going either way. But again, if I had to put $10 on it, I'd say the Rams.
I'll tell you, Caleb Williams, I probably saw him play four games. I don't have to give up my Sundays like you do, Ian, and watch all this stuff anymore. But when I watch him play, that guy is a complete quarterback. Man, is he strong, tough to get down, elusive when he has to be, accurate when he passes, and confident. I'm looking at a guy, this is his second year. I think it's his 10th.
Yeah, you're right. And man, the improvement from last year to this year, again, when you get Ben Johnson in there and you get a real head coach, what a difference, particularly somebody who knows how to work with quarterbacks. And when I see him play, I see a young Aaron Rodgers, just faster. And so he has everything. And yeah, it's going to be that combination, Ben Johnson and Caleb Williams, is going to be a real problem for people to deal with over the next 10 years.
Aaron Rodgers gone. You wrote a book about him. Is he? Do you think he's gone now? Retires?
I do, because if Tomlin stayed, I think he would have played another year in Pittsburgh. I really do. Tomlin leaving, really, he's not going to play. He's not going to stay in Pittsburgh. Now, the options to me are retirement, which is probably the best option, or maybe Minnesota. They gambled on J.J. McCarthy. They kind of lost that gamble. Kevin O'Connell, the coach of the Vikings, really likes Rodgers. That's a possibility, but I think the more likely and the best case scenario for him right now at age 42 is to say goodbye. He got a dignified ending to his Hall of Fame career. He wasn't getting that, certainly, with the Jets getting fired by Woody Johnson. I think this was a good enough ending and allows him to say goodbye.
I would say this about J.J. McCarthy. So many people, sometimes it takes quarterbacks 3 or 4 years, 5 years. This guy's had 1 year. I mean, I don't know what he's showing. He seems to be fiery and confident and a natural leader, certainly from a fine program. I would not unless that coach, who knows quarterbacks by anybody else, says he doesn't have it, I overestimated him, which is scary because he got a chance to see him and scout him and picked him and let Darnold go to keep him. So unless he says he's let me down or he's got an off-the-field problem, I would not give up after a guy in 1 year. Look at Darnold and the Jets. Look at Darnold and he was what? This is his fourth team now?
Right, Brian. I think, well, he got hurt last year and then he got hurt some this year too. So that's a problem. I'm talking about McCarthy.
And
O'Connell really has a good relationship with Aaron Rodgers and they considered him seriously last year. So and I think you're right. He'll probably stick with McCarthy, but it's not 100%.
So, Ian, how much? It looks like Dart did a lot of recruiting. I thought it was classy of Brian Daboll to talk with Harbaugh and tell him what a great organization it is. After all, they just fired him 4 months ago. I thought that was awesome. Coughlin got on the phone with him. So I think that he's wanted. When do you think the press conference will be? And lastly, the best thing about him and the reason why I talk about him, he's a class person. In everything you hear about, he treats people with dignity. He has a great sense of values and ethics. And that all figures into his smarts as a coach.
Coaches with humanity, Brian, he does. And I think a little bit more of a kinder, gentler version of his brother, Jim Harbaugh. But this is, it's a home run for the Giants. I think the press conference would be Tuesday, most likely.
Did you say Monday? I'm sorry, you said Monday?
I think they'll skip Monday for the holiday and do it Tuesday. But they got to hammer out the final details today, which I think there's a 95% chance they'll do that, announce it, and then... The Giants hopefully are finally off to the races.
And the other thing is, he actually answers questions at a press conference. Some of these coaches say nothing. They go out of their way to say nothing. He will actually answer questions, and it kind of makes it more interesting in New York. Ian, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Read Ian in The Athletic. Pick up all his books. You'll never be disappointed. Thanks so much, Ian. Have a great weekend.
Great seeing you, Brian. Thank you.
You got it. Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Is it still the president's assessment that it would be very hard for Ms. Machado to leave Venezuela because he says she lacks the respect and support in that country? And will he raise that with her today?
I think the president's assessment that you just pointed out was based on realities on the ground. It was a realistic assessment based on what the president was reading and hearing from his advisors and national security team. And at this moment in time, his opinion on that matter has not changed.
He has also said that he would like there to be elections in Venezuela when the time is right.
That's right.
Do you have any update on when that might be? And is he committed to a transition to democracy for Venezuela?
Yes, and he is also committed to hopefully seeing elections in Venezuela one day, but I don't have an updated timetable for you today.
So that is just a little give and take yesterday when it comes to Venezuela. Maria Conchita Machado was there, Nobel Prize in hand, gave it to Trump. He never should accept it. I'm sure he won't. They're not allowed to pass it off. And she just says, look, she thought she was going to be installed right away. And at first I thought, why not? But what he's saying, what the president's saying, what the CIA told him, it's not a whim. It's not like I don't like women running countries. After all, the vice president is a woman. Now she's a president temporarily. I don't love the way her track record, more of a socialist communist. And her husband is basically the Speaker of the House there. So part of the corruption. But if you get out that government, you lose all the institutions. And even if she's popular, she doesn't run the country yet. And we don't want to have to stay on the ground until she does. Or until another election's happening. Make sure you watch One Nation Sunday at 10 p.m. on The Brian Kilmeade Show.